Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Michael McCoy, the program director of Louisville's Neighborhood Institute. First, formal investiture ceremonies for the newest justice of the Kentucky Supreme Court were held last week at the state capitol. Among those witnessing the event was Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh.
Following the recent retirement of former Chief Justice Joseph Lambert, a judicial nominating commission recommended three lawyers to fill his unexpired term. Governor Beshear chose Daniel Venters of Somerset, who has almost 25 years' experience as a district and circuit court judge. Venters immediately began hearing cases.
Silence is commanded for the justices of the Supreme Court of Kentucky while they are sitting.
One month into his new job, family, friends, colleagues, and dignitaries gathered at the state capitol to witness Venters' formal investiture. Among those praising him was Governor Beshear, who couldn't resist pointing out Venters is a West Virginia native and Ohio State graduate.
But then he got a lot smarter. He had the good sense to get his law degree in Kentucky and move to the Bluegrass State permanently. So I chose not to hold those prior errors in judgment against him.
Beshear says Venters is highly respected.
He listens. He treats people with respect and dignity. And he follows the law.
Congressman Hal Rogers, who gave Venters his first job out of law school, says he has great respect for the man, whom he called a personal friend and confidant.
The judge is here today to join your ranks and serve the 3rd Supreme Court District with the same intelligence, the same forthrightness, fairness, strong work ethic that I saw some 33 years ago. The governor has chosen wisely.
Do you solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the Commonwealth, and be faithful and true to the Commonwealth?
Chief Justice John Minton delivered the oath of office, after which Justice Venters, assisted by his mother Mary and wife Jane Adams Venters, donned his black judicial robe.
Congratulations, Justice.
Taking his seat on the bench, he was welcomed by his 6 colleagues. And Chief Justice Minton praised Venters' recent return to private practice.
That is a very, very important perspective for us to have. And so we're glad to have a practicing lawyer among us who understands what it's like to be in the trench and having to face folks like us on a regular basis and deal with clients and deal with issues in the practice of law. That's a very important grounding, Dan, and we're glad that you bring that perspective to this group.
For his part, Justice Venters told the gathering he's been blessed in life, quote, far beyond what I deserve, but says he never envisioned serving on the state's highest court.
This is, judicially speaking, in Kentucky where the buck stops, and I feel awed by that responsibility, but at the same time, I'm comforted here by the fact that there are 6 other honorable and brilliant people with whom I share that responsibility, and if I get too far afield, they will rein me in.
The Supreme Court seat is on the November ballot, but Justice Venters has no opposition. Hyden lawyer Leonard Brashear qualified to run, but recently withdrew his name from consideration. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
You can see a picture and learn more about Justice Venters and the rest of the Kentucky Supreme Court at our website, WFPL.org. Now in its 22nd year, the Neighborhood Institute has been cultivating civic leaders throughout Louisville. Its newest class of recruits starts a 12-week course of training later this week. I spoke with Program Director Michael McCoy about the program and how it's changed the landscape of Louisville's neighborhoods. Well, let's begin, Michael, with a little background information. Exactly what is the Neighborhood Institute?
Well, that's a great question. The Neighborhood Institute is a program that's about 20 years old now that is one of the flagship programs of the Center for Neighborhoods. And the center was formerly known locally as the Louisville Community Design Center. Most people may know it more by that name. And the Institute itself is a program that is aimed at increasing the knowledge and skills required for effective neighborhood leadership. And it's a program that is a 12-week, one evening per week from usually around 6 in the evening till about 8:30. And it's 12 sessions that are aimed at introducing resident leaders in different neighborhoods or just individuals that are interested in becoming neighborhood leaders to many of the resources and skills necessary for them to be effective at that job, basically.
And these are neighborhoods all over Louisville?
All over Louisville, as well as even occasionally individuals will actually cross the river and come from southern Indiana and participate as well.
How many participants have you had over the years?
Well, our classes average somewhere between 35 to 40 students each. I'll refer to them as semesters, and we've had, therefore, about two semesters a year for 20 years. So quickly doing the math, that's probably about 1,500 or 1,600 participants over the life of this particular program.
And your fall class begins soon, correct?
It does indeed. It begins this coming Tuesday evening, and this year we're on our fall class, concentrating a little more on kind of the southern and southwestern neighborhoods. So we've decided to hold this session at the Beachmont Women's Club, which is on South 6th Street in the Beachmont neighborhood.
So you have each class takes place in a different part of town. Is that how it works?
We're beginning to do that more frequently. For several years, we held the class consistently at the Clifton Center and found that to be very convenient for a large percentage of the population for access. And this past spring, one of our co-sponsors, in addition to Metro United Way, that has been a sponsor for this program for several years now, was the University of Louisville and its Signature Partnership Program. And as their interest is really focused on the West Louisville and initiatives in that area of our city, we held the spring semester at the NIA Center on West Broadway to make it easier for participants from the western neighborhoods to get there.
Now, there's no cost to participate in this, right?
No, absolutely not. There's not only no cost, dinner is provided at the beginning of every class, and all of that is through the generous support of our sponsors. And like I said, it's Metro United Way and have been consistent sponsors for a number of years now.
What happens at these meetings, Michael? They have different speakers and different presentations?
That's exactly right. We do everything from kind of group sessions of kind of breakout sessions to begin to learn about and practice group dynamic skills and leadership skills and community organizing skills, as well as having almost every week a different guest speaker come in and talk with the class about their particular area of expertise. And those range from Metro agency personnel. So we will have, for example, Bill Schreck from the Inspections, Permits, and Licenses, or Charles Cash with the Department of Planning and Design Services, to individuals that assist these leaders with skill sets such as grant writing, community organizing, the beginnings of Block Watch programs, greening initiatives, so they can learn about community gardens and programs that MSD is currently sponsoring, such as their rain barrels. So it's a whole variety of information.
Well, you've been doing this. This has been going on now for more than two decades, so you must be seeing some positive results.
We are. You're exactly right. Initiatives that come from the Neighborhood Institute are generated through one of the class requirements, which is that every participant actually works throughout the semester, beginning to develop the kernel of a neighborhood improvement project that they devise and get assistance from both their other classmates that begin to help them refine their program and begin to think through what kind of partnerships they'll need in order to make their particular project successful. And then they actually make a short 5-minute presentation near the end of the semester presenting their project and the reasons for it and their expectations and their strategies for success to the rest of the class at the end of the semester. And hopefully then the Center for Neighborhoods will supply technical assistance and ongoing support after the class is over to help different leaders in different neighborhoods see some of their dreams come true.
Is it still possible to enroll in the fall class?
Well, the fall class is really pretty much full at this point. We currently have actually about 43 or 44 participants that will come to the first class. Generally, we do see a certain small percentage, generally 5 or 6, that will begin having either scheduling conflicts or they just realize that perhaps this isn't a class that there is tailored for specifically their needs and may choose to drop out. So we usually admit a few extras at the beginning of the semester to allow for some decline in membership to the point where we generally have that 35 to 40 as the solid group by the second or third week that will then stay with us throughout the entire 12-week session.
But you do have another session coming up in the spring?
There will be a session coming up in the spring. Information about that will be posted fairly soon on our website, which is centerforneighborhoods.org. And we always have a section on there about the Neighborhood Institute and information about upcoming sessions and schedules.
All right. Michael McCoy is Program Director of the Neighborhood Institute in Louisville. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're more than welcome. I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
That was Michael McCoy, Program Director of the Neighborhood Institute in Louisville. You can learn more about the program at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about the role of corn in the country's ever-changing energy horizon. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up a little later in the show, Robin Fisher talks with the author of The Year of Living Biblically. First, the Louisville Forum last week focused on an issue that's permeated the presidential race and discussions on the economy, energy, specifically the role of corn in the future of America's energy. Here's a portion of the presentation at last week's Louisville Forum.
Our first speaker today will be Ron Litterer. Ron serves as a president of the National Corn Growers Association. This association represents more than 32,000 individuals across 48 states. Ron is also a committee member on the USDA Agricultural Policy Advisory Committee for Train and National Corn to Ethanol Research Advisory Board. He is a graduate of Ohio State University. Ron has been farming for 29 years. He and his wife Janice and two daughters farm corn and soybeans near Green, Iowa. Please welcome Ron Litterer.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here today, and it's really Iowa State University instead of Ohio, but other than that, that was a great introduction. I really, really am glad to have the opportunity to talk to you today about energy, because as you know, we've been very involved with the ethanol side of it. Our vision for ethanol is to produce 15 billion gallons of ethanol by the year 2015, and that's a few short years away. And we think we can do that by producing 15 billion bushel of corn also and still provide all of the needs that we have for our export markets and our livestock industry. We're well on the way there. This year, corn growers are going to harvest more than 12 billion bushel. Last year, we harvested over 13 billion. And a part of that will go to about 9 billion gallons of ethanol production this year, 2008. And we're still providing needs for all of our other markets as well. As a part of an overall alternative energy scenario, ethanol will provide three key benefits. It helps reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Number two, it provides support for our domestic economy, especially in rural areas. And number three, it helps us protect our environment. Today, the United States imports nearly two-thirds of its petroleum, while the Middle East is home to two-thirds of our world's known oil reserves. For every barrel of oil produced, 1.2 barrels of petroleum ethanol produced, 1.2 billion barrels of oil are displaced. In 2008, U.S. ethanol production is displacing an equivalent of 330,000 barrels of imported crude oil per day, which is more than one large oil tanker per week. Ethanol helps keep the cost of gasoline from being even higher. A commodity strategist from Merrill Lynch recently estimated that expanding biofuels helps reduce the price of gasoline by nearly 15%. A Extrapolating that for the nation at large, that means that U.S. consumers are spending or saving approximately $70 billion at the pump every year. When you consider the huge impact fuel and energy prices have on food prices, this last point is an especially important one to remember. Every year, the Renewable Fuels Association commissions a study on the economic impact of ethanol. In 2007, the ethanol industry added more than $47 billion to the U.S. gross domestic product. The ethanol industry has created or supported nearly 240,000 jobs. It has put $8.2 billion in federal, state, and local government treasuries, more than what went out on the tax subsidies to support the industry. And when it comes to the tax credits or government subsidies, remember that in 2006, ethanol received only about one-third of all federal subsidies for energy. Research by the U.S. Department of Energy's Argonne National Lab shows that ethanol has the ability to significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. According to Argonne, in 2006, the production and use of ethanol has reduced carbon dioxide equivalent greenhouse gas emissions by about 8 million tons. That's like taking 1.2 million autos off the road or our highways every year. The Environmental Protection Agency noted that for every BTU of gasoline replaced by corn ethanol, a total life cycle greenhouse gas emissions that would have been produced from the BTU of gasoline is reduced by almost 22%. Ethanol's environmental sustainability goes hand in hand with the fact that U.S. corn growers are focusing on stewardship of the soil, water, and air that are so important to our profession. Thanks to this technology on the farm and even in the seed, growers are using pesticides and nutrients more efficiently than ever before, producing more corn for each pound of inputs. And we're also disturbing the soil less to help prevent runoff. So in conclusion, I believe that everyone on this panel all recognize that our energy solution should be one that is well-rounded and diverse, as our energy needs and resources themselves are. As a result, we should think of the energy solution in terms of a collection of fields where we can all excel by sharing our resources and working together. With our collective expertise, we can make this a better country in which we can all live and prosper. Thank you very much.
Sorry about the Ohio State there. Our next speaker today, and hopefully I'll get this one right, is Andy McDonald. Andy is the coordinator for the Kentucky Solar Partnership, and he is also the co-author of the Kentucky Solar Energy Guide, which was published in 2005. He has a master's degree in sustainable systems from Slippery Rock University of Pennsylvania. He's not going to get that one wrong. He also has a BA in philosophy from the University of Buffalo. He is the co-founder and chair of the Kentucky Solar Energy Society and has been working to promote a socially just, sustainable society for the last 15 years. He lives with his wife and stepdaughter on a farm in Franklin County. Please welcome Andy McDonald.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for the invitation to be here today. I appreciate the opportunity. The Kentucky Solar Partnership is a project of a nonprofit organization based in Mount Vernon, Kentucky, the Appalachia Science in the Public Interest, that's been working for over 30 years on issues related to renewable energy and sustainability. And the Solar Partnership works to promote not just solar energy, but renewables, energy efficiency, sustainable energy alternatives all together. When we think about solar energy, there's a variety of different solar energy technologies. I often get calls from people who are interested in putting solar on their home, and they don't understand that there are different technologies. There are photovoltaics that generate electricity. There are solar thermal collectors that capture the heat energy from the sun and use that heat energy directly. And that's commonly used for water heating. You can also use that for space heating. Another way of using solar thermal energy is through passive solar design, where it's built into the design of the home itself. And Another form of using solar energy is daylighting. You can let the natural daylight into a building and avoid the use or the need of electric lighting, or reduce the need for electric lighting. So to begin with, it's important to understand that there are different ways of utilizing solar energy. Another major and developing solar energy technology is not something we would put on a home, but something that's generating power at a utility scale. Concentrating solar power plants are being used in the desert southwest, in Spain, and in other countries. And these power plants are producing hundreds of megawatts of power. They produce power on the scale of coal and nuclear power plants, but they use the sun's energy to generate electricity. This is a very important and growing energy potential, energy production opportunity for the world. And I expect we will see much more of concentrating solar technology in the coming years. Here in Kentucky, I want to talk about the possibility for two of these solar technologies and what the potential is. Currently, there's a very small usage of solar energy technologies in Kentucky, to be honest about it. There are maybe a few hundred homes that are using either solar photovoltaics for electricity or solar hot water systems. But the potential is to have hundreds of thousands of homes and tens of thousands of commercial buildings using these technologies. The technology has arrived. We're not waiting for solar technologies to develop anymore. They have been here for years. And you can go to other states and other countries, and solar photovoltaics and solar thermal systems are commonplace. You can go to California, and there are many, many, many homes and commercial buildings that have these technologies. Germany is currently leading the world in the installation of solar energy systems, and Germany will actually pay you 45 cents a kilowatt hour if you generate solar electricity and put it on the grid. And you can imagine what a difference it would make if you could get that incentive here in Kentucky. So these technologies have arrived. And I often hear people say, well, it's too cloudy in Kentucky. Solar doesn't work in Kentucky. I've heard engineers say that. And that's simply not true. Kentucky has very good solar energy resources. They're not as good as Arizona's, but they're a good deal better than Germany's. As I said, Germany's leading the world in the installation of solar energy technologies. Their solar resources are similar to Alaska and northern Canada. Kentucky's solar resources are better than that. And so it's not the natural resource that's limiting us here in Kentucky. It's largely has to do with the fact that electricity and energy has been so inexpensive in this state. And that has not created a financial incentive for the investment in solar. But we all probably recognize that energy prices are rising and will continue to rise. And as Kevin indicated, there are other social reasons for switching to renewable energy, having to do with its impact on the environment, energy security, national security. So as we think about these other reasons for switching to renewables, we can realize that solar energy can be a very important part of the switch. And there are economic development opportunities inherent in that as well. I submitted testimony to the Public Service Commission earlier this year or last year in a case related to the development of renewable energy and energy efficiency. And I did an analysis for that testimony that I submitted with the Sierra Club and my organization. And from a simple analysis, we could install over 600 megawatts of solar electric and solar hot water systems in Kentucky. If we put 100,000 solar units on 100,000 homes, we could generate 250 megawatts of photovoltaics. That's about the scale of a coal-fired power plant. If we put solar hot water systems on 100,000 homes, we could have over 100 megawatts of power. That's in the scale of a coal power plant. If we did the same on commercial buildings, both for solar hot water and photovoltaics, we could generate another 300 megawatts. And that brings us over 600 megawatts of power from solar energy. This is doable. This is using technology that's already on homes and buildings in Kentucky. Now, installation of on this scale would meet 1% of Kentucky's annual electricity generation. 1% is a significant number. It may seem insignificant to you, but if we could get to 1%, imagine the economic development that would occur. It would ramp up the whole industry to a level where solar would be on par economically with the other technologies, with coal in particular. The U.S. Department of Energy is projecting already that solar photovoltaics will be on par, will be equal in cost to conventional power by 2015. Now, what can Kentucky do? What do we need to happen in order to make this concept come to reality? Well, I think there are two major policy moves that are needed. We need incentives to really help solar develop. We need the critical things that we would need would be a public benefits fund. 19 states around the country have this fund. It's a fund that's often generated from a small surcharge on utility bills that enables investment in renewables and energy efficiency. And a public benefits fund would create potentially tens of millions of dollars a year that could be invested, not just in solar, but in the broad range of renewable and energy efficiency technologies we need to develop. The other strategy is a renewable portfolio standard that would require the electric utilities to meet a percentage of their generation from renewables and from energy efficiency. And it's these two policy mechanisms that have driven the development of renewables and solar in other states and that would enable it to take off here in Kentucky. These are established, tried and true policy mechanisms, and they could work here in Kentucky. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Our next speaker today is John Malloy. John has 28 years of experience in the electrical and natural gas industry. He started his career as a technician at Louisville Gas and Electric Company. And now, 28 years later, he's working for Eon US and is the Vice President of Energy Delivery for Retail. He has led strategy development on global warming and environmental planning. Malloy has also led the Eon US International Fossil Generation Efforts for Operational Excellence. John has a bachelor's degree in finance and a master's of business from Indiana University. Please welcome John Malloy.
Well, thanks for the introduction. It's been an interesting day for me so far. I started off early this morning with her at a Green Awards banquet, so our breakfast, that went well. I just sat with my CEO and others talking about smart meters and conservation because I've moved as a supply-side strategist over to the demand side. So I'm kind of going back a year or two when I worked on the supply side to talk about the value of coal. Some of the most crucial energy decisions we will occur in the next decade in regards to energy. Energy is the number one topic on all the political minds and on the minds of everyone in the Commonwealth. They will have lasting implications. We know that. We are currently living with the decisions, the supply-side technologies, that were decided in the 40s, 50s, and 60s up through the 70s. The decisions we make today will be forced on those that come after us. So it's important to have lively discussion in forums such as this. This forum provides the avenue. We've been traveling the state in regards to Eon US and the nation for that matter, talking about conservation, supply-side technologies, and what will solve some of the energy problems. In the energy industry, we are fundamentally charged with advancing three fundamental duties: energy production to meet demand, supporting the national and global economy, and protecting the environment. This is where coal comes in. America has the number one coal reserve position in the world. The economic realities of this position are evident. Kentucky is indeed a coal state. We also know how Saudi Arabia has exploited their oil reserves. U.S. production of coal exceeded 1.1 billion tons in 2007. And we're talking about electricity production. Of that 1.1 billion tons produced, a billion were utilized in coal-fired generation. And more than half the electric generation in the United States is generated with the utilization of coal. However, the 2000s are much different than the 1970s. 3 billion global inhabitants have awakened to modern electricity use. As nations around the world realize the benefits of electrification, the world's appetite for energy will continue for the foreseeable future, creating enormous and sustainable energy needs. Two large global players absent in the last decade are India and China. The new combined demand for electricity from these two nations continue to strain the co-production markets, even in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. India will build 75 gigawatts of coal-fired power plants by 2012. China, just last year, constructed 96 gigawatts of coal-fired generation. The world simply cannot keep up with the growing demand for electricity in the absence of coal as a primary fuel. Central premise here, the world simply cannot keep up with the growing demand in the absence of coal as a primary fuel. The supply and availability, regardless of price, of all other energy forms fell miserably in comparison to the abundance and availability of coal. Let's talk about oil. Persistent high prices, the ethanol charge to offset some of the volatility in pricing, and some of the international hostage-taking that we've seen over many decades. Natural gas, very high prices, also exceptionally volatile. It's sourced from volatile regions. We talk about liquefied natural gas being the solution to some of the coal issues that we have and some of the carbon footprint issues across North America. It's seeing economic pirating on the open seas. So even LNG shipments into North America are being rerouted to other nations willing to pay a premium to pick up our natural gas. Let's talk about nuclear. Valuable in power generation, however, constrained by extremely high startup cost. In the absence of favorable governmental permitting and a regulated climate where returns to stockholders are guaranteed, the investment risk-return relationship simply fails. Biomass. Biomass is constrained in uncertain supply and fails in the volumetric needs of large-scale utilities. Wind, likely the greatest generation source to complement coal and nuclear, however, needs a very large geographic footprint. Offshore production is problematic and costly. Generation is unpredictable as the wind. 25% capacity factor in wind. We are consumers that consume at will, not only when the wind blows. So as a primary source of energy, it also fails. Let's talk about renewables. Few new rivers to place new hydro generation. Pump storage operations from hydro suffer high cost and high public resistance. Legislation and regulatory oversight are operationally burdensome. Photovoltaic technology, still evolving, costs are coming down, but still not at the scale to displace coal. All resources required to replace existing electricity from coal production across the United States violate the fundamental supply-demand balance. Just will not happen. Let's talk about replacing coal. We would need 140 million acres committed to wind alone, 400 new nuclear plants. Natural gas would have to double its current production, 3,000 times more solar than currently in use, 700 hydroelectric facilities the size of Hoover Dam. Too much data? Absolutely. However, it's important that we understand coal's competition because, as I said, demand continues to climb. We simply cannot run off coal. Regardless of our environmental desire to do so, coal will be with us for many hundreds of years. In light of this, coal remains at the forefront of electricity production, complemented by a variety of other supply-side resources. It is that balancing of the supply-side portfolio, along with conservation, which I'm keen on, but will be spoken to just shortly, that will balance the overall demand-supply equation.
You've been listening to a portion of last week's Louisville Forum. To learn more about the forum, energy, and corn, go to our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about one man's quest to live for 1 year according to the rules laid out in the Old Testament. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Author A.J. Jacobs is not afraid of a challenge. For his first book, he read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. And this time he's turned his attention to the Bible. From trying not to lie to playing a 10-string harp to stoning adulterers, Jacobs tried to literally follow as many biblical laws as possible for 1 year. Robin Fisher spoke with Jacobs about his new book, The Year of Living Biblically.
Well, I got to tell you, when I first started reading the book, it was more than I expected it would be, actually. And I wanted to ask, you know, how did you really think there would be so many rules? I mean, both written and unwritten rules to follow?
No, it was much harder than I ever anticipated. I mean, it affected, I was trying to follow every rule in the Bible, especially the Old Testament. And there were over 700 rules that I found, and they affected everything I did, from the way I ate to the way I talked, the way I thought, walked, what clothes I wore, how I touched my wife. I mean, it was a radical transformation.
And it was just amazing to me because, you know, like you said, every aspect of your life, but then some of them were a little contradictory. So how did you narrow it down? And then what did you end up with? 70?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was hard. One of the things I did was I gathered a board of spiritual advisors to help me through all of the nuances and contradictions. So I had rabbis and priests and ministers all advising me. It turned out to be impossible to follow every single rule. I mean, you just can't do it. Think of the rules like the Bible talks about: no lying, no gossiping, and no coveting. And I live in New York City and work in the media, so that is pretty much 65-70% of my day. So, it is. I loved the attempt to try to live completely biblically, and I love trying to have this moral makeover, but in the end, it is impossible to follow them all.
I thought it was very funny. I think it's toward the end of your book. You talk a lot in the book about simply the difficulty in not lying, you know, even when you don't realize that you're lying, when you're sort of, you know, padding the truth or, you know, trying to not hurt someone's feelings, but how your wife Julie caught on to the not lying. And so, you know, that innocuous question, "What are you thinking?" became like this major, you know, grilling.
Oh, it was terrifying whenever she said, "What are you thinking?" because it wasn't all these biblical thoughts. And you can't believe how much, once you start to pay attention to it, you can't believe how much you lie. Or at least I lied. Even as a father of a young child, lies will get you through the day. If you try to tell your child the truth 100% of the time, you're in for some serious tantrums.
I thought it was interesting as you follow the Bible, as you got further into your quest, I guess that's the best way to say it, as you got further into your quest, you almost developed this alter ego, Jacob.
It's true. I mean, that was one of the things. It started out somewhat as a lark. I did have serious intentions, but as I got deeper and deeper into it, it became more and more serious, and I felt myself becoming this biblical character, and I named him Jacob. My name is A.J. Jacobs, so Jacob seemed an appropriate biblical name, and he looked different, first of all. This man I became had a huge beard, and by the end I was wearing robes and sandals and carrying a walking stick. So it was an extreme religious makeover.
Is he gone now? Did he leave when the beard left?
Well, certainly I'm not following all the rules anymore. You know, I stopped stoning adulterers, for instance, and I went back to wearing clothes of mixed fibers. But there were many things that left a huge imprint on me. I changed more profoundly than I expected. Everything in dozens of ways, everything from the Sabbath, I still try to follow the Sabbath, to not gossiping. I try not to gossip and my wife and I grew up agnostic with no religion at all. And my wife and I now, we did join a synagogue. We're Jewish, and, we don't go really that often, but we did join because I thought it would be nice to give my son just a little taste of religion, so he could choose whether or not he wants to follow that. I'll be happy no matter what if he becomes an atheist or a believer. I don't care as long as he's a good person.
Well, you brought it up, so now I have to ask you about the stoning the adulterers, because there are many parts of the book that are serious, but there are some laugh out loud parts in the book.
Well, thank you for saying so. You make me commit the sin of pride when you compliment me, but I'll take the compliment. It is, the stoning is a huge part of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, and I felt I had to address it somehow. So I did end up, I was in the park, and an elderly man came up to me, and he said, "Why are you dressed like that?" And I was wearing my robe and my sandals, and I explained, "I'm trying to follow everything in the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers." And he looks at me, and he says, "I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that would be great." So I took out a handful of stones that I had been carrying around in my pocket for just this occasion. You know, I had been hoping to run into an adulterer, and they were small stones. I felt this was my loophole. This was my way to follow the letter of the law. So I had small stones, and he actually, this man grabbed the stones out of my hand and threw them at my face. So he was very aggressive and made the first move. I felt an eye for an eye. I could throw one back at him. So that was my experience stoning.
And it's just this image and these little stones, you know, bouncing off of him. But he was just this cantankerous old man.
He was a cranky old man. Yeah, he was not, I don't advocate stoning, but, he was not a sweetheart. Let's put it that way.
You mentioned earlier your board of advisors, and one thing that I wondered was, as time went on during that year, were you surprised at the various ways that people followed the Bible? Like, you know, everyone has a different interpretation, even if their interpretation they consider to be literal.
It's true. I mean, it is fascinating to see the vast differences in the way people interpret the Bible. And also the question of what do the words of the Bible mean? How should we interpret them? Should we try to find the original intent, like Antonin Scalia tries to find the original intent of the Constitution? Or do the meanings of the words evolve over time? And one thing that was also surprising is that I thought that on some of these obscure laws, I would be the only one in the entire world trying to follow them. But I was sadly mistaken, or not sad, I was grossly mistaken. For instance, there's a law that's in the Psalms that talks about how you should worship God on a 10-string harp. I thought I'd be the only one in the world playing a 10-string harp, but there's actually quite a cottage industry of 10-string harps for people who want to worship God that way.
Well, and there was some comment that you made in the chapter when you visited the Creation Museum, and you said that that there was someone that was even too strict, even for them.
Well, that was, yeah. And when I went to the Creation Museum and met some creationists, they talked about some people who were geocentrists, who believed that the Earth was at the center of the universe, because there's a line in the Bible that says that the stars shall move around the Earth. And the creationists rejected that. So that was one of the big lessons of the year, is that no matter what your beliefs are, there's always that other guy who believes something even stranger. So there's always a continuum.
Has this experience changed the way that you interact with other people?
Well, it has. I mean, I'm much more, first of all, I think, and this might be boasting, so I probably shouldn't say it, but I think I'm much more grateful in general. I'm much more tolerant. I'm much more, and I'm much more appreciative of many of the aspects of religion. There are lots of things that I disagree with about religion and fundamentalism in particular. That's one of the real concerns of my year, was people who say they take everything in the Bible literally. I wanted to show that that was not the best way to approach the Bible. But then I learned there are many, many wonderful things about religion as well.
I have to ask about Julie, your wife. She seemed to be the perfect foil.
She is, as some people have emailed me, she is a saint. She put up with quite a bit. Some of the parts she liked. She liked that I took the Sabbath and spent it with a family, or that I became more grateful. She liked that. But there were other parts that drove her absolutely crazy. There's a part in the Bible that says that you cannot touch women during certain times of the month. And even stricter, in the Leviticus, it says you cannot sit on a seat where a woman in her time of month has sat, because then it's impure. So my wife found this offensive and sat in every seat in our apartment during her time of month, and I was forced to stand for much of the year.
And that made me laugh. That, and when you refused to take the picture with Julie and her mother, and then you said you had a little sidebar, and then you agreed that you would take that last picture.
That's right, yeah, because the Bible says you cannot create images if you take the second commandment very literally, no images. But, you know, sometimes you have to be flexible, and this was one of those times where Julie laid down the law.
Now, you say in the book that Ecclesiastes is your favorite book of the Bible.
I do find it a beautiful book, and one of the messages in Ecclesiastes that really struck a chord with me is that life is uncertain. This is the part of the Bible that says, the race does not always go to the swift. Bad things happen to good people, and we cannot explain it. The best life is a mystery, but the best we can do, says Ecclesiastes, is to enjoy the good things that God has given us, or if you're an agnostic, the good things the universe has given us. Food, drink, honest labor, your family, these things you should appreciate. So I thought it was a beautiful book in the Bible.
In the paperback version of your book, The Year of Living Biblically, there is a book group suggestion. I don't know if you are aware of it, but
yes.
They suggest that the book group try and follow the Ten Commandments for 7 days. What advice do you have to a group?
Well, my advice would be don't get discouraged if you realize that you break probably 9 out of 10 commandments a day. You probably, hopefully, you don't kill every day, but or commit adultery, but lying, you certainly are going to commit that every day, and probably worshiping false idols. I mean, idolatry is whether it's idolizing celebrities or idolizing money. We all do that all the time. So we're very fallible. But it's a really, I found it to be an amazing experience to try to at least try to do a moral makeover, to do this radical change in behavior, and it does have lasting effect.
Well, AJ, what's your next project? Are you going to try and cook everything in the joy of cooking?
That's a good idea. I wrote a book on reading the encyclopedia before this one. That one I felt was about the mind. This one was about the spirit. So my next one, I figure I should take on the body. So I'm going to do trying to become the healthiest person in the world.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you, Robin.
And thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with A.J. Jacobs about his new book, The Year of Living Biblically. Jacobs will speak at the main branch of the Louisville Free Public Library Wednesday evening at 7. Visit our website for more information, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio. a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.